The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Empowerment Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericaempowerment.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Welcome to From the Boardroom to the Bedroom, the Protocol Praxis, with your host, Suzanne Z. Pedro. This program will catapult your awareness in the mastery of power, influence, and persuasion. Journey to the uncharted conversations of human interactions and discover your winning capital. Now, from the boardroom to the bedroom with Suzanne Z. Pedro.
Hi, everybody. I have a great guest today, and she'll make you happy, but then maybe I might not make her happy. I have some really great questions for you, my guest, Catherine Sanderson, who positive psychology. She teaches at, she's been schooled at the top universities, Princeton, everything. And I know we have a little late start, so I apologize for that. But welcome, Catherine, Dr. Sanderson. How are you doing today?
I am doing well. Excited to be here.
Oh, thank you. I just have to play devil's advocate right out the box. I know Bill O'Reilly even says that, you know, the pursuit of happiness. But is it always, what's so great about pursuing happiness? Because sometimes when you can't get that happiness, it hurts.
Well, so a lot of research in psychology actually suggests that happiness is within everybody's power. So there are things that we often think about happiness as in external things like I need a new job or I need more money or I need to get married or I need a baby. But lots of the research in psychology suggests that those are not the kinds of things actually that make us happy. That what makes us happy is how we think about the world, how we think about ourselves, how we think about the world. And some people, you're exactly right, that some people may have an easier time finding that happiness. It may come more naturally to those people, but that everybody can learn skills and strategies that they can use in their own life to try to increase happiness, no matter where they start.
Okay, but Dr. Sanderson, don't you think in order to find happiness, you have to go down sometimes to the pits of despair?
Well, I think that
balance, maybe not the pits, but I mean, if anybody, I mean, you would have to be like, the one that Piper Tree, whatever, that so skips around every day. I mean, is that normal for somebody to be like that happy every day?
Well, I think there's a difference between being happy. I mean, one thing that researchers often debate, and this might be sort of the key part of your question, the one thing researchers often debate is what is happiness? And some people think of happiness as being sort of deliriously happy, you know, joyful, sort of like a, you know, little kid on a swing set, you know, swinging back and forth and laughing. But other people think about happiness in terms of feeling of contentment, that feeling like overall, they're living their life well, that they're at peace with where they are. And still other people think about happiness in terms of meaning. Are they pursuing things in their life, in their community, in their work, et cetera, that are personally meaningful? And so part of the question really becomes, when we think about happiness, how are we conceptualizing it? How are we thinking about it? And certainly evidence suggests that people can be happy and it can sort of increase their day-to-day, their moment-to-moment happiness, just by doing small things. So it doesn't mean being happy by, you know, going through intensive therapy and sort of staring at your demons necessarily. It means that even sort of small things like going for a walk outside or getting enough sleep or doing something kind for a friend, that all of those things can have a small effect. But if we do those things regularly, those small effects over time can really add up to making us feel much happier.
And so what you're saying, I'm trying to, everybody has the individual happiness levels, right?
Yes.
And what might be happy for me might not be, you know, like contentment or happiness for somebody else. So when you're with a, you know, like as a couple, how do you achieve that, you know, culmination of happiness? I mean, is that difficult to do?
Well, there's very interesting research that sort of looks at gender differences in some of this. And certainly one of the things that seems to be consistent is that over time, men have benefited more from marriage than women. Now, I'm going to say that with a little bit of a caveat because there's not yet a lot of research on same-sex marriages. And also, there's lots of evidence that gender roles in marriage are, of course, changing dramatically. So some of this research, in fact, is built on samples collected in the, you know, 50s and 60s and 70s. But a lot of that research suggests that, in general, marriage is very good for men, that men who are married are very happy, and they're not only happier than women or than single men, but married heterosexual men are healthier, they live longer, they make more money, they're less likely to be hospitalized for psychiatric disorders, etc. So overall, marriage for men seems to be very good. On the other hand, what's really interesting is that the research suggests, again, at least historically, that married women are happier than single women only if they're in a high-quality marriage. So if they're in a marriage in which they feel loved and supported and valued, married women, in fact, are happier than single women. The challenge is that for married women, again, heterosexual populations, married women who are in unhappy relationships in which they don't feel loved and validated actually show lower levels of happiness than single women. So some research suggests that men may have a little bit of an easier time finding happiness because for men, simply the state of being married may produce happiness, whereas for women, they really need to have a high-quality relationship in order to experience the same benefits of marriage.
So I have to wonder, like, I mean, what you just stated, is that men, when they in a good relationship, kind of like their mother, you know, like, I mean, am I out of the box saying this? But I mean, it seems like when they're taken care of and they're in a good position, that they do live long and they feel quality relationships. And would that have any symbolic meaning, like with, you know, mother-son relationship?
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, your instinct on that is exactly right, that one of the issues is that in many traditional heterosexual marriages, men are taken care of, that women often, you know, take care of, even if they work outside the home, women often take care of managing the children, of making sure the house is clean or gets cleaned. Women often are more responsible for dealing with issues of, you know, cooking. Women also are typically responsible for sort of social engagement. So they may, you know, coordinate dinner parties. They may buy the holiday gifts or arrange birthday parties and things like that. So I think you're exactly right that part of it is that marriage traditionally for heterosexual men has been about being taken care of. And it is about, you know, that feels good. That feels supportive. And again, that may be why men in general experience a benefit from marriage and that women really need to have a high-quality relationship. Another thing that I think relates to that finding is that if you ask married heterosexual men, who's your best friend, they overwhelmingly say, my wife. My wife is my best friend. And if you ask married heterosexual women, who's your best friend, they say, my best friend. And invariably, they don't say it's my husband, that men and women seem to rely on their spouse to meet different kinds of needs.
And that's what I was just getting ready to think of, because it's different needs for male, female. Like, the male gets his needs met, like, you know, coming back from the mother image. But how can a male make a woman happy? Like, security? I mean, what really does that for a woman? I'm trying to...
Well, yeah. So I think part of it is that men who are in marriages in which they are making their partners happy are basically thinking also about, you know, her needs and whether that's, you know, her need to be able to go out and have a, you know, evening with a book club, or being able to, you know, if the husband works and the wife doesn't, to be able to get home in time so that she can go for a run, you know, after work, or can meet a friend for a drink. That part of it, the research on marriage shows that women are better off in marriages in which the husband is sort of attentive to her needs as well. And that may in fact be about giving space and time for the woman, the wife, to be able to pursue things that make her happy, which again could be reading a book, could be exercising, could be traveling, could be spending time with, you know, friends or family, but basically making sure. Part of the challenge is that being happy takes time. It takes making some choices in your life about how you spend time. And so to the extent that people in marriages or other kinds of romantic relationships can allow their partner the space to do the things that make them happy, it's really important. And sometimes in the crunch of day-to-day life, people don't take the time to do the things that would make them happy. Or they say things like, well, you know, I'll golf more once I'm retired, or I'll go back to reading for pleasure once the kids are out of the house. And the problem is that we often put off doing things that would make us happy.
Well, you know, I mean, this incredibly high divorce rate. And, you know, research shows that more and more people are less getting married.
Yes.
Right? And is it that we're getting too selfish, too into our own, you know, like what we want, what we need, and not fulfilling, you know, the other person's need?
Right. That's, I actually teach a seminar to my college students on close relationships, and that's exactly one of the big topics we discuss. You know, what accounts for this increase in divorce rates / decrease in marriage rates, and it's a really interesting question because there's sort of a lot of different ways to think about it. So one factor clearly is that people no longer have to get married in the same way that we once expected it. So it's no longer, you know, sort of seen as a requirement that everybody gets married. Certainly people are now more comfortable with same-sex marriage. So people who used to maybe feel a need to get married to hide issues of sexual orientation aren't doing that anymore. It's also the case that there's much more acceptance of single parenthood. So women in their, you know, 30s and 40s may say, well, I really want to have a baby, and I haven't met Mr. Right yet, but I'm going to go ahead and have a baby. And there's sort of a different societal acceptance of that. So that may be a part of the factor. But I think it's also the case that if you look at the totality of the research, it's not that marriage predicts happiness. It's that having close friends and family predict happiness. So people who are married aren't necessarily happier than people who are single. What matters is that people have people in their lives who they love and they care about. And that could be a spouse, but it could be a romantic partner that doesn't involve a marriage. It could be a best friend. It could be a sibling or a coworker or a parent or a cousin. So I think the issue is that we need relationships in order to be happy. That's really, really important. But we have lots of flexibility about what that is in terms of the exact nature of that relationship. We have lots of flexibility.
And especially, I know, with women, you know, when we have close girlfriends, and you might not have somebody significant other in your life, but if you have a close girlfriend and someone, like you say, and somebody relationship you can share with, that that kind of tends to override the, you know, the male, you know, we don't have to have male, female, you know.
Right.
That we can do it. And it seems like women have a lot of closer, correct me if I'm wrong, but closer time together sharing than men. Men might go out and they might talk about football, but what do I do? I'm not stereotyping, but women seem to have more like emotional connections.
Yeah, well, and you are 100% right. And there's actually some very there's some really interesting research that has looked at that, including by one of my colleagues, Buffy Aries, who's done some research on gender differences, even in friendships. That you see this the exact pattern that you described. You actually see even before adulthood. You see that in children. You see that in girls in 5th and 6th and 7th and 8th grade doing that same sort of difference. And what seems to be the case is that girls and women's friendships involve much more talking, much more sort of emotional sharing, disclosure, vulnerability, intimacy, and you see that in part in the patterning of friendships, that often girls and women go out with, one or two people, and the activity that they're doing is having coffee or having brunch, because what they're really doing is talking, and maybe they're meeting for a glass of wine during it, but they're basically sitting down and catching up with each other's lives and talking. And what you see much more often for boys as well as men in their friendship patterning is it's much more activity driven. We're going to, play a game of basketball. We're going to play ping pong. We're going to watch the football game on TV. It's often driven by something that's much more activity-based and much less about sort of vulnerability. And that's also true in the content of the conversations, that the content of the conversations may be much more about work or about politics or about the game they're watching or the event they're doing, and much less about sort of personal vulnerability, sharing, intimacy. And so in a sense, girls and women get a lot more practice having relationships because they're used to doing this honest self-disclosure sharing from their friendships with other girls and women.
So how would you counsel, ladies to say, like, how can I get my man, my significant other to, like, get on an emotional level? Because they got what we knew. What is it, men from Mars, women from Venus, whatever.
Right. Yeah, so one of the issues is that women have a lot more practice doing it. And so that women may say, well, this is really frustrating, my spouse or my, boyfriend or whatever won't open up or won't share things. But the reality is they don't have the same amount of practice. That sharing and opening up is much easier for women because they sort of have a lifetime of experience of doing this and lots of practice, even, in elementary school in talking. So one of the issues is that husbands, men, boyfriends, et cetera, they need more practice doing it. So to the extent that women can give them opportunities to do it, they can get better at it. They can recognize that this is important. There's very interesting research that shows that both men and women prefer to talk to women. So if you ask men, let's say you have a serious problem and want to get advice about it, they will often say, well, I would ask my wife, or I would ask my sister, or, I would ask my, coworker who's a woman. That both men and women tend to prefer to want to talk to women because they find it easier to open up to women than they do to other men.
And that makes sense because a lot of, powerful men, they've had really powerful women behind them.
Mm-hmm,
and that,
mm-hmm.
For that advice, which shade it is or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's so true. But, I'm still trying to figure out how to tell a man to, listen. Do you think, let me retract.
I don't know of research showing consistent gender differences, across the lifespan. I'll say a little bit of information that we know from sort of the best evidence possible. So one bit of evidence suggests that overall, across the lifespan, women tend to have higher levels of depression than men. And that's true in all age groups, actually, except during college, in which men and women, college students seem to show equal levels of depression. But pretty consistently, women report higher levels of depression than do men. But one of the problems with even sort of drawing conclusions from that is that it may be that women are more willing to admit to feeling sad or feeling lonely or feeling depressed, and that men in our society often, you know, are told, you know, don't cry, keep a stiff upper lip, you know, don't let things get you down. So part of the issue may be that men simply aren't willing to admit to feelings of sadness or loneliness or depression, and therefore they're underreported in the large scale surveys of that.
Okay,
but we also know that there's pretty clear evidence that men take more joy in parenting than do women. And that's probably in part because women take more of the stress of parenting, that women take much more of the stress in terms of, you know, the day-to-day experience of changing diapers or doing laundry, et cetera, whereas dads, you know, may come home for work and say, let's go for ice cream or let's go throw a football or something. And so part of it may be that it's a very difficult job for women to parent, and they do sort of a lot of the grunt work, whereas for men, they can experience more of the joys of parenthood because it doesn't have to be, so tricky.
Dr. Sandstone, we're getting ready to go to break. I can't wait to get back into this. That'd be great.
Great, okay, thank you.
Dr. Sandstone, thank you.
It's your world. Motivate, change, succeed. VoiceAmericaEmpowerment.com.
Have you ever noticed that sometimes life just feels easier, especially when judgment of you or anyone else ceases to exist? What if you could function from that space all the time? What if gratitude is the key? Every time you are grateful for someone or something, a new universe opens up. What difference can you create in your life and the world from the energy, space, and consciousness of gratitude? Join us on Access Consciousness Presents Beyond Saying Thank You every Tuesday at 12 noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Empowerment Channel.
Are you a business innovator, or are you just sitting on the sidelines? Tune in every week for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP. Host Bonnie D. Graham talks to a cross-section of the movers and shakers who are leading by example. They will share best practices and innovative ideas to keep you thinking and moving along with the best. Join us for Coffee Break with Game Changers, presented by SAP, Wednesday mornings at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, 8 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to Facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our wall. Just go to Facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
It's your world. Motivate, change, succeed. VoiceAmericaEmpowerment.com.
Have you friended us on Facebook yet?
Why not?
Just go to Facebook.com/Voice America or search for the keywords Voice America. Once you are part of our Facebook network, you'll receive daily messages about what's happening with our shows, this week's featured guests, and new happenings at the Voice America Talk Radio Network. And you can add your voice to the always active discussions on our wall. Just go to Facebook.com/Voice America or search for Voice America.
This is From the Boardroom to the Bedroom, the Protocol Praxis with Suzanne Z. Pedro. To reach the show today, give us a call at 1-888-346-9141. That's 1-888-346-9141. You can also send us an email anytime to protocolpraxis@gmail.com. Now, back to the show.
Hey, we're back with Catherine Sandstone, who Professor Sandstone's research examines how personality and social variables influence health-related problems with health, mind, body, and happiness. Welcome back, Professor. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Enjoying
good.
The conversation.
Thank you. Okay, so that's a very important point, is that you make the mind-body relationship with health and happiness. How do you, if somebody's, you know, like feeling really down and their body's down, what are some ways that people can, you know, increase the oxytocin in their endorphins, make it happier.
Yeah, that's a really cutting edge and important question with lots of clear research evidence. So one of the really most important things that people can do if they're feeling kind of depressed or they're feeling kind of glum is they can do certain behaviors that seem to actually improve how their brain is functioning and also improve, as you noted, level of endorphins in their bodies. So certainly research suggests that there are behaviors that we can do very clearly. That includes getting exercise. And that could be a cardiovascular exercise like running or playing tennis or swimming. But it could also be something like yoga or meditation. Again, we have lots of flexibility about what kind of exercise. It's also clear that people who get enough sleep, that people who feel fully rested and rejuvenated show higher levels of happiness. One of the strategies that I like best, and this is sort of ironic as I talk to you staring out at snow outside and more snow expected here in Massachusetts tonight, but one of the clear things that seems to help people feel better is being outside in nature, that looking at nature makes people feel better, being outside, you know, taking a walk in a park. There's a really interesting study that was done a number of years ago with patients in a hospital that exactly speaks to your question about mind and body. And what they did in this study was they looked at patients who were hospitalized for a routine procedure, the same procedure. And the way this hospital was set up, there were two different wings. And one wing of the hospital overlooked a parking lot. So patients in that wing looked out on you know, asphalt and cars, et cetera. And on the other wing of the hospital, the patients looked at grass and trees and flowers and shrubs. And they simply measured in this study how long patients took to recover from the exact same surgery depending on which wing of the hospital they were assigned to. And what they found was that patients who were in the wing that overlooked parks and trees and flowers and grass required less pain medication. They were rated by the nurses as doing better. They accomplished all of the different surgical milestones faster, like getting out of bed and being able to walk, etc. And most importantly, those patients got discharged from the hospital faster. So they were actually recovering at a faster rate and therefore were able to leave quicker. So that's a really good example of how the mind and body is really, really very closely connected and can have an impact not just in our psychological well-being and happiness, but also on our physical well-being, our health.
Okay, you know, I also heard that, believe it or not, I don't know how, I mean, this is research shows that people that are on Facebook, that their oxytocin level goes up, that they're, you know, that they're feeling connected to people that they might be shut in, and all of a sudden that they have friends and stuff like that. So technology also, when you say also increases that level of happiness to some people?
Yes, and I think the key part of your sentence there is for some people. And that's one of the really tricky things about technology is there are lots of ways in which technology can bring people closer. So, you know, Facebook lets people, you know, stay in touch with friends and family members who live, you know, very, very far away. Things like Skype and FaceTime let people, you know, email, you know, cell phones, all of that lets people stay in really good touch even if they're, you know, away from their loved ones for some period of time. I think the challenge in terms of looking at issues of social media is that in some cases, people can also feel lonelier. So there's some interesting research looking at Facebook in particular, showing that people who are lonely and don't feel particularly good about themselves tend to post more negative things on Facebook. So they tend to, you know, post more about bad things that have happened to them. And then, of course, people don't respond positively, and that leads to sort of a negative loop, whereas people who feel happier about themselves are much more likely to post positive things, and then people, you know, like those things, and that gives people a real boost. And so one of the challenges is that Facebook seems to cut both ways, that it can make people feel happier and connected, but for some people, there seems to be a real downside to Facebook in making them feel less good about their own life in some way.
Well, that makes sense, because all of a sudden you see somebody posting like, oh, I'm in Italy, I'm having fun here.
Well, right, and you've raised yet another really important point, is that Facebook also can lead us to have sort of negative comparisons, that everybody else's life on Facebook seems magical and seems exciting, and then we look at our own lives and, you know, we're sitting around and we're doing nothing on, you know, New Year's Eve or Valentine's Day or whatever. So Facebook definitely can cut two ways.
And then I like to, since we're talking about media and stuff like that, I want to ask you about the news. People that are, let's say, like, over, that they are addicted to watching the news 24/7, does that impact them?
That's a fascinating question. Yeah, no, I've never been asked that question before, and I don't know of research off the top of my head that looks at that. I think the challenge is that looking at the news, that we see certain kinds of things overrepresented in the news, right? That the news is more likely to report, you know, bad things. So the news reports, you know, accidents, and it reports deaths, and it reports crimes, you know, natural disasters, et cetera. So that to some extent, you know, lots of exposure to the news could make people feel like the world is a less safe and secure place because there's all this sort of negative stuff going on. So it certainly is possible that the news could have a negative impact on happiness, although I don't know specifically of research that that has shown that, and that's a really interesting question.
But, I mean, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, right?
Right, exactly, right.
Okay, so what happens to the people that are reporting this day after day? Do they have impact, or they get just immune to it?
Yeah, well, so certainly research would suggest that people who experience traumatic events have more difficulty finding happiness, and so that could be traumatic events like, you know, being at war or being the victim of an assault or something like that. But it's also the case that people who sort of are regularly exposed to negative images and negative stories may also need to develop coping strategies to prevent those experiences and even hearing about those experiences from impacting them. So many therapists, for example, have therapists who they talk to as a way, in part, of processing feelings they may have after hearing sort of, you know, major negative experiences. That's certainly true for doctors who work with patients who are, you know, at great risk of dying. So oncologists, for example, may rely on colleagues for support as a way of being able to process and share difficult things that have happened.
Okay, I mean, you make a good point with, like, oncologists, people that day in and day out that, you know, deal with death and dying, like, you know, funeral home directors and stuff like that.
Right.
How do they search for that happiness?
And part of that is that research shows that people who have jobs that they find meaningful, that they have personal meaning in their jobs, actually experience higher levels of happiness. So I imagine that people who are funeral directors or people who are oncologists or, you know, people who are dealing with really difficult things have developed a real sense that what they are doing is very meaningful. So maybe oncologists can't save everybody, but maybe oncologists can help buy patients and their families a little bit more time, or maybe they can help patients and their families prepare for the inevitable in a way that feels supported and safe and maybe focuses on quality over quantity. Similarly, funeral directors, you know, are dealing with people who are at an extraordinarily difficult period of their lives and a moment, but they may find great meaning in helping to make sure that people's loved ones are remembered and paid proper respect to, and that the service includes, you know, joyous memories and, you know, stories and emotions as well as ones that are sad and full of grief. So I imagine that in both of those jobs and in other careers in which you are, you know, sort of surrounded by trauma in some way, that people find ways of looking for meaning and hope even in those experiences, and that, in fact, you know, could lead to greater happiness, that they're doing something that matters, that's important for other people.
Okay, so we're talking about, like, you know, people with their businesses and doing things on a greater level. What about people that just spend money to want to feel better.
Right.
What do you say about that?
Because I know you're talking about that.
There's certainly interesting research that shows that spending money shopping makes people happy. That's not ever the most surprising thing I talk about. But what's in fact even more interesting is that we experience higher levels of happiness when we spend money on other people than when we spend money on ourselves. So have you ever had a really great feeling of happiness after you found like the perfect gift for somebody?
Absolutely.
That's an example, is that people find higher levels of happiness when they find that gift than if they get a gift themselves, that finding the perfect gift for somebody makes people very happy. In one very clever study, and it was done in a number of different countries, they brought in people for a psychology study, and half of the people were told, you're going to do this study, and then you're going to get this little gift bag. So the people did the study, and then they handed them this little gift bag and said, this is to thank you for coming in. Here's your gift bag to keep. The other half of the people in the study came in to do the study finished, and they said, thank you so much for coming in, and to thank you for participating in the study, we are going to donate this gift bag to a local children's hospital in your honor. So these people didn't get to keep the bag. They got to see it, and they got to know that it was going to a children's hospital, and in fact, the people who knew their bag was going to the children's hospital reported higher levels of happiness than did people who got to keep the gift bag themselves.
Build your better business. Achieve that goal. Make good on that resolution. The Voice America Empowerment Channel. It's your world. Motivate, change, succeed.
What sets apart VoiceAmerica.tv from the other video content providers on the internet? Choice and flexibility means that you can host your video content live or on demand on the main VoiceAmerica.tv channels through your own branded media player or your own private TV channel. We support multiple media formats, so all of your video content can be in one place. We offer a number of advertising and video packages. For more information, visit VoiceAmerica.tv. If you think you've seen online TV like this before, let us surprise you.
Do you feel like sometimes you just don't know where to start with?
How do you achieve balance in your life? Is it when everything runs in perfect alignment with each other? Time, money, and life? You can keep everything in nearly perfect balance. Listen for Be Mighty with K.D. Marley, which is made up of two people, K. Mar and D. Lee. The hosts have worked with small business owners to find the best and most systematic way of tracking both time and money in order to achieve work-life balance to their advantage. The show can help you, too. Listen Fridays at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Empowerment Channel.
Credit stressed? Need credit repair? The Federal Credit and Business Police, the FTC, state they've never seen a legal credit repair clinic. If those so-called credit repair and debt negotiator illegals are not smart enough to get legal, what makes them smart enough to solve your credit problems?
Hi, I'm Bruce Danielson, founder of First Stone Credit Counseling, the one company that is U.S. Treasury approved and competent to do credit file restoration. We're not collectors in disguise or consumer ripoff artists. In fact, First Stone is a consumer advocate credit file restorer with a U.S. Treasury 501c3 nonprofit certification who has resolved thousands of credit problems over the last 18 plus years. First Stone can put you back on track to financial freedom, and you can start right now by calling
First Stone at 972-235-1188. That's 972-235-1188. Or check the website firststone.com. That's FirstStone.com.
Follow us on Twitter for more great ideas at Voice America Empowerment.
This is From the Boardroom to the Bedroom, the Protocol Praxis with Suzanne Z. Pedro. To reach the show today, give us a call at 1-888-346-9141. That's 1-888-346-9141. You can also send us an email anytime to protocolpraxis@gmail.com. Now, back to the show.
Hey, we're back with Catherine Sanderson, Dr. Catherine Sanderson, professor of happiness, psychology. positive psychology. How did you even get in this field?
Well, I teach a lot of classes. I teach at Amherst College, and I teach lots of different classes since it's a small college, and that those include classes in social psychology, in health psychology, in close relationships, and basically there were lots of overlapping themes that were true in all of those classes about the way people think, the way people behave. And I developed this talk that sort of summarized what the state of the research is based on my own teaching and writing. And I've now been, you know, delivering this talk to education and corporate audiences and have had a really great time doing it.
Okay. Can you tell us about the shaky branch study from Cornell?
Yes. So there's
that was a popular dating theme.
It's a very popular dating theme. And what they did in this study, which was done a number of years ago, but a super clever study, is they had people, men walk across either a shaky bridge or a sturdy bridge. And it was literally done, the study was done outside. And the bridge was over a big giant ravine. So the men completed a little survey, and they walked across one of these two bridges and handed their survey to the female experimenter. And in the condition of the sturdy bridge, they simply walked across the bridge like you'd be, you know, walking across the living room or something, and it was no big deal. It was very high handrails and very steady. But in the shaky bridge, there were low handrails and the bridge swayed back and forth. So you sort of had this feeling that maybe you were going to plunge to your death as you walked across the bridge. So you're, you know, swaying back and forth, you know, walking very carefully. And of course, because you just have this feeling that you might plunge to your death, your muscles are tense, you're breathing fast, your, you know, heart's racing, etc. And you, in both conditions, you hand the questionnaire to the female experimenter. And in the shaky bridge condition, you hand the question to the female experimenter and you look at her, and of course your heart's beating fast, your muscles are tense, you're, you know, breathing fast, and you think to yourself, gosh, look at this reaction I'm having to her. I must love her. You know, look at my body's reaction. And what they found was that when the woman said, hey, if you have any questions about this study, please give me a call, that people who walked across the shaky bridge were much more likely to call the female experimenter to follow up with a question, you know, over dinner or whatever, than did people who walked across the sturdy bridge. So that was a research study that was done a number of years ago, but the findings in that study about the importance of physiological arousal in predicting attraction, you know, are now often described in the popular press, including in a recent Modern Love column in the New York Times a few weeks ago. And this finding is very, very consistent. It's also used as the basis for what we often see with the very, very popular reality TV dating shows, where the bachelor comes on, is dating 25 different women, and then all of a sudden over the course of, you know, 6 to 8 weeks, he has to choose which ones to keep and which ones to send home. And what they need to do on these shows is they need to convince the audience that they're seeing somebody fall in love, that they're seeing a love story develop. And so the people who are on the TV show need to be convinced that they're falling in love. And so what you see on these shows are all sorts of really exciting, adventurous dates that are mimicking what you see in the Shaky Bridge study. So they're going on dates that are, you know, going heli-skiing. They are going in hot air balloons. They're doing all sorts of things, rappelling down a skyscraper. They're doing all sorts of things to try to create physiological arousal, which in turn will lead the people on the show to feel that they're falling in love, and that will increase sort of audience interest in, look at this love story I'm falling. So the Shaky Bridge study is another great example of the connection between mind and body.
That's what I like to teach. It's like, you can make a guy think. You go like on the edge of a cliff, and you do that because it mimics the same arousal as which what happens when you fall in love. I mean,
exactly.
Absolutely. Oh, my God. That's a great study. I love it. I didn't know what it was called. They actually had a study called that. And they did that. But sure, I mean, and then all you have to do is then chocolates and then all, you know, all the, you know, how can I put it now? Aphrodisiacs, right?
Yeah, no, well, and it could even be something like
your body
going to a scary movie or going to, riding a roller coaster with somebody. I mean, anything that's kind of creating the feeling of physiological arousal.
And I saw on these shows that when they jumped off a parachute off a building, and, you know, that they did it together, and it was just like, you know, it was together. And I mean, they had the same emotional, physiological response.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that. They actually had a study of that. Okay, let me talk about pets.
Yes. Pets are a great form of happiness. Pets provide unconditional love. Pets make us feel needed. Pets often have a sense of how we're feeling. There was a very recent study showing that dogs actually have a good sense of how their owners are feeling, can recognize different kinds of emotions. So pets seem to be a really important predictor of happiness. What's also interesting is that a certain kind of pet, and that is a dog, seems to also increase our life expectancy. That they've done studies looking at people who are pet owners and people who are dog owners in particular seem to live longer than do people without pets or than people with other kinds of pets. Now, a little bit of the challenge in looking at that research is we're not exactly sure why you get that effect. So one possibility might be that people who have dogs have to walk the dogs. So maybe this research is not really showing that dog owners live longer. Maybe it's showing that people who get regular exercise live longer.
Oh, Catherine.
Yes.
Catherine. Dr. Sandstone, thank you for being my guest.
Well, thank you.
Being James E. Austin, Professor of Psychology at Amherst College and Positive Psychology. Thank you. I hope you gave everybody. Oh, great. I know you did.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in this week. Your host, Suzanne Z. Pedro, will be back again next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time, for another edition of From the Boardroom to the Bedroom, the Protocol Praxis. We hope you'll join us as well.